Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. Welcome to the podcast. Today we have Greg Spillane. Had an early career as a professional athlete and then went on to a very prolific tech career where he's founded various businesses and currently runs fancy.com and has a lot of interesting strings to his bow, which we're probably going to go into and talk all about like mindsets and how to take on new challenges. And I'm really excited to have you on the podcast. So in your own words, because they'll be much better than mine, can you just quickly introduce yourself in like 3 minutes, a bit of a life history?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from the East Coast, but grew up on the West Coast. So spent most of my life in Southern California. You know, probably similar to you, just sort of like a very curious type of person, always doing different types of things. Was an athlete growing up, was extremely into sports, competition. But I think a little bit of that dichotomy was I was also a little bit of that computer nerd, kind of introvert as well. So, you know, got a computer very early on, sort of taught myself how to code when I was a young kid, all while being an athlete. So I actually started my career as an engineer. Quickly learned that like sitting behind a desk all day coding what other people are telling me to code was just not for me. I just did not have the attention span for it. I really enjoyed it when I was doing stuff for myself, but when you start doing it for other people, it loses a little bit of that joy. So ended up founding my first company when I was about 25 years old. Started off as an agency, moved into a software development firm, built a number of different products that we took to market, had an opportunity to exit out, sell that. And then I decided I wanted to go work with really large companies. So I moved into the management consulting inside of it, working with Fortune 50 companies, Walmart, HP, Sony, those types of companies doing huge digital transformation, systems integration types of projects. And it was during that time I went back, I got my MBA at University of Southern California. And while there, actually I met a gentleman named Greg Parise. We became fast friends and business colleagues. And the only reason I say that is he ended up becoming the CEO of a company, brought me in to be a COO. 2012, moved back into the startup world with a company called Bump at the time. We took them through an entire pivot, became events.com, built that company up to pretty moderate success. And since then, I've really been working closely with Greg. Greg's an investor now, and I've kind of been brought into these different, somewhat distressed companies in a variety of roles to manage turnarounds. And that's how I was brought into Fancy. So yeah, it's been a really interesting ride. Don't know how I quite became the turnaround guy, but that's sort of what I do now.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way that things end up being the way they are. I guess if you tried to tell someone that's what you'd be doing when you were younger, it would be a bit weird.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm still at that point in life where I think, you know, most of my friends, definitely my parents and family, like literally have no idea what I do. So it's kind of funny.
It's certainly an interesting time to be in person, like managing change when there's so much change going on. I'm sure you got some useful advice there in terms of dealing with crises. But before we start at the end, let's start at the start and go back to growing up and things. So you said athletics, as in you were literally just doing like sort of sprinting and jumping and things. What did that mean?
I was that kid that always had a ball in my hand. You know, I was very self-motivated from that perspective. I would go out and start front lawn and, you know, throw a ball against the wall, you know, hours upon hours and just, you know, daydream of myself playing in the major leagues or go out and shoot baskets for hours. And, you know, I was the kind of guy that it was like, I'd go from football season to basketball season to baseball season, volleyball to, you know, whatever it was. I was always playing sports. I was always competing. It was just a big part of who I was as a kid.
Do you think like the competition set you up for business then? Just always wanting to like beat others and be the best and stuff, or completely unrelated?
Yeah, no, look, I think the competition part of it is probably somewhat innate. You know, maybe that was what led me to enjoy the sports side of it. I mean, I do like to compete. I enjoy competing. You know, I think I've become a better loser over time. I think when I was a kid, it was really difficult. And maybe at times I could have been difficult because I didn't like to lose. But, you know, you kind of learn that. Where I think sports has really helped me, though, on the professional side is, you know, when I got to higher levels of sports and team sports, especially, and working with coaches and really seeing the meritocracy that's involved in athletics. athletics, you know, in any type of sport, right? I mean, whether you're playing football, soccer, Olympic sport, whatever it is, you know, at the end of the day, if you're at a high enough level, you're only going to play if you're good, and you're only going to win if you're better than the person you're next to. And that just doesn't happen without hard work, right? And if you don't put in the work, if you're not doing the things that need to happen, you're not practicing hard, and you're not deliberately practicing to get better, you know, you're not going to be successful. And I think that, you know, that stuff that I did early on in just my life in general has carried over to my professional life and those types of things I try to do myself as best as I can, but I also try to instill in my team.
Cool. Was there any defining moment of success during your athletic career?
Oh man, I think probably one of the most defining moments I had was I was a freshman in college and I did something that was just dumb. It was like kind of like a disrespectful thing more than anything to somebody, like where we ate lunch or something like that, like a food hall. And I remember the head coach of the team brought me into his office and just tore me a new one. I mean, just, it was the ultimate, you know, you don't have the right to be here. You're here because we have chosen for you to be here, and we can also choose for you not to be here. And I was attending college on a scholarship and, you know, kind of like full board and tuition. And, you know, it was one of those things where I had a lot of family and friends and people that were following me. And it was like kind of one little dumb moment of maybe me thinking I was a little bit too entitled, and then really quickly realizing that that could all be wiped away by me just being kind of a little bit of a jerk. And I think that moment more than anything stuck with me, right? It was like the defining moment of that, like getting rid of the entitlement, I think, that some maybe young people have real early on and realize like you're not entitled to anything. And, you know, if you're not willing to kind of be a good person and do those types of things, like that stuff can be taken away. So, you know, I mean, as far as a defining moment, that's something that really sticks out of my head and I think about a lot.
It's really interesting. It's a hard one to learn when you're young, but I think we kind of remember these moments. Anyway, what made you stop? I guess, did you like realize that you weren't going to be majorly successful, or you just had other aspirations suddenly?
Athletics is one of those things that the sport will tell you when it's time to stop. You know, I got to a point where I knew the time was there, right? I'd kind of gotten beat up. I had some injuries, surgeries, that type of stuff. But, you know, the game continues to get better. And, you know, it wasn't like I was like the best of the world at what I did. So it was just time to move on and move into my professional life. And I think I was ready to do that. You know, I was ready to kind of take on that next challenge and do the different things that I haven't done. So, you know, it happened early on. And, you know, I was excited to move into the professional world. And, you know, you go in thinking, you know, a lot more than you do, and then you realize you don't. And God, it's such an evolution.
100%. So how did you like go around turning your skills into an agency? Because I guess you said you're like 25 at this point.
It really started with doing some freelance stuff like it typically does. And then it's funny, I had a project come up that was probably a lot bigger than I was capable of doing at the time. And I was like, well, I want to do this because I need the money. And, you know, maybe I can find somebody to sort of do the work for me. I'll hire somebody and, you know, I'll just pay them a little bit less than what I'm charging the client. And I did that. I didn't even really know what I was doing. Took on a project, ended up hiring a couple different people to do the work. I sort of managed the relationship with the customer, you know, manage the work that needed to be done. I mean, occasionally I jump in and do a little bit of something myself and thought to myself, wow, there's the business here. I can turn this into something. Then, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we're talking 2001, 2002, 2003, everybody was going online, right? Everybody was looking to digitize things. So we did a good job and that helped. And that allowed me to have enough money to establish ourselves as a company and get our own website up. And then it was just a lot of word of mouth. I didn't do a lot of proactive, real like marketing or selling at that point. Early on, it was like the first couple projects were, you know, people I knew, referrals from the last project. And then, you know, we did build a presence and we started to do some active selling and I brought on a salesperson and we were doing those types of things. And what ended up happening is, you know, at that time, the real estate market in the US was really taking off. It was kind of right on the buildup of what ended up being sort of the collapse. And a lot of these different agencies were looking to build their own online presence. The mortgage industry was big. There were a lot of people who were buying leads. So we built a couple of different products, really as like one-off products for customers, but, you know, maintain rights to the IP. And we realized that there was an opportunity to really take these products and go more specific. So we built a product built for the real estate brokerage firms that was, you know, similar to, I guess, what kind of like Redfin or any of these different type of companies became, right? It was before this was actually something that you saw all the time, but we took, you know, like Google Maps technology and we were able to overlay real estate properties on top of that. So on any agent or broker, website that they had, you could go to the website and get a search locally in your area. Not only would you see the homes for sale, but you'd see the homes for sale, like, you know, gridded on an actual map. And that's something that we all expect and see now. That at the time was kind of brand new technology. So we moved away from being an agency really to more like a software firm. And we still did some custom development. It was subscription based. And ultimately, you know, when we were able to exit out of it, that was the IP that we sold.
That's kind of an interesting time to be getting into these things. Do you think if you could go back to that time, you'd have done something different or done it faster? Like, what advice would you have given yourself?
Oh man, I made so many mistakes. You know, one of the things I didn't know back then is about raising capital. I did it all myself. I bootstrapped the entire company, and there's pluses to that for sure. I mean, you obviously own the company, you know, you don't have other investors, but we were really on to something. And I think we had an opportunity to expand and grow and become much bigger than we were. We were really more of a regional company at the time. I mean, we had customers all around the country. You know, we had a couple salespeople doing some sales type stuff, but you know, we didn't have the money to really invest and to build sort of a uniform technology platform that worth scale. And, you know, at the end of the day, when I did exit out, you know, part of it was a little bit of just that founder fatigue as well, where, you know, it was like, as much as we were doing, it was really difficult to manage the business on a day in day out basis, managing cash flow. I didn't have that background per se, really, to understand sort of the ins and outs of finance and running, you know, HR for a team and trying to make the right hires and all those types of things. So I think we were successful almost in spite of ourselves, but that's ultimately what led me to go back and get my MBA. I went to business school because I realized I wasn't fluent truly in the way business worked. And one of the best decisions I ever made in life, I think the decision to go to business school, you know, if someone asks me, I kind of try to understand why they would make that decision. If it's just simply to bolster a resume, I don't think that's the best reason to do it. But I truly needed it because I needed an education in business. And, you know, when I started my company early on in my career, I didn't reach out. I didn't have great mentors. I didn't have people around me that were really helping me sort of learn things that I needed to know, that if I was going to go ahead and start a company today, you know, I would have probably taken a very different path in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I do kind of wonder the value of like MBA, because I've never done one. I'm kind of intrigued to see what I would learn or not. And yeah, I've interviewed the CMO of Free Trade, which is like Robin Hood, but for the UK. And he did an MBA as well, sort of having got some life after sort of 10 years. He went back and did that and said it was really useful. And maybe I should go do one, perhaps. But currently my own startup, a little bit busy to be doing one. But also I think making some of the similar mistakes and perhaps should be focusing a bit more on raising capital or something to just move a lot faster. So it's a confusing time.
Do you experience stress or have anxiety or chronic pain or have trouble sleeping at least once a week? Well, you're not alone. Many of us do, and personally, I happen to be a woefully normal human prone to all of these things. I'm always trying to find ways to transcend my problems, as you'll be well aware by now, and I was searching for anything that would help on this issue, and I discovered Feels. Feels is a premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep, and Feels naturally helps reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. So this is great for my muscle pains and my broken leg and getting a good night of sleep after a stressful day of work. It's really easy to take. You place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and you can feel the difference within minutes. It's important to remember that everyone's dose is different, so leave room to experiment over the course of a week or so. And what's great is they have real human support. So if you're new to CBD, they offer a free CBD hotline to help guide your personal experience and help you feel better naturally with no high or hangover or addiction. They have a simple membership. You can join the Feels community to get Feels delivered to your door every month, and you'll save money on every order. And you can pause, cancel at any time. So Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member by going to feels.com/growth, G-R-O-T-H, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/growth to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. feals.com/growth.
Do you think you could have raised capital at that age, or was it like a mindset problem, not thinking you could do it? Or did you also need kind of the network and some of the credibility of having run something successfully and sold it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I could have raised money at that age. It's kind of embarrassing to say. I just didn't know you could do it. I wasn't tapped into that world to that level. I was really heads down into sort of the tech and doing it. I didn't realize that there was this whole VC world, and their entire existence came about finding young tech companies and young entrepreneurs and people they believed in and giving them money and giving them advice and helping them scale and grow. I don't know what it was. I was in San Diego. San Diego wasn't exactly like a huge tech hub. I'm sure if I was in the Bay Area at that time, it might have been a little bit different because of just the network and the people that were around me. But yeah, I was just kind of naive to that world even really existing at that point in my career.
It's a funny one because you sort of have like, yeah, this mindset that it's for something like outside of your world or something. And yeah, it's almost like you're sort of taking money from something when actually like they literally exist to sort of fuel people like you trying to build companies. If you're able to sort of make more money and then potentially give them like a return, like that's the point of them existing and they kind of want to talk to you and we'd love to have you in their boardroom.
I was maxing credit cards and, you know, Greg Barnes stealing to make payroll every week, you know. It would have been nice to tap into that network. But, you know, look, it worked out well in the long run. It just, you know, going back in time, that was definitely something that I would probably have looked at a little bit differently if I could do it now.
Cool. And have you raised capital like now for your current projects?
Yeah, it's funny because over the last however many years, when I moved back into the startup world, raising capital has been just a huge part of what I've done. So I feel very comfortable in that world. I think as a CEO of a company, in many ways, a company that's still a startup and not profitable, raising capital is like your number one chat in many ways. We're raising money at Fancy right now. We're in the process of going through a fundraise. Obviously, this sort of crazy apocalyptic time that we're living in now has slowed things down a little bit from that perspective. But yeah, it's definitely a world I've really done a 180 on and have become very familiar with over the last few years.
So into basically the management consulting side of like getting involved with like Fortune 500 companies, because from like being a 25-year-old just running agency development, that's sort of like, it's like a very big jump.
Yeah, you know, it was something that was like, you know, you think early in my career, you know, kind of go back in time. You know, I described it. I built something almost in spite of myself. You know, I had a technical background. I was very scrappy, sort of pulled some pieces together, saw an opportunity, capitalized on the opportunity, built some products, made a ton of mistakes along the way, but, you know, was able to, you know, have some success because we built a pretty cool product and people were interested in it. At that point, I had this like fascination with like IBM and Accenture and Deloitte. And, you know, it was like this world that existed that I wasn't real familiar with, right? So I wanted to learn more about it. I wanted to understand what that world was. So I kind of took a proactive approach at it, you know, and worked with a headhunting firm and some recruiters, had a story and, you know, got brought in. So my first role was with a company called Softech Integration Systems, actually a big Latin American player. They were a huge SAP partner and they were looking to expand sort of their North American, you know, business development presence. They were looking for people to kind of run BD out of North America. So I got brought on by them and real early on, just had some opportunities to present themselves, built some relationships, personal relationships with an advisory firm called Forrester. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but Forrester does a lot of consulting with Fortune 500 companies. You know, that led to an introduction to Walmart. And Walmart at the time was looking to build a integration center. They acquire a number of companies and they were looking to build this center of excellence in which they could handle all their back office integration. So their HR systems, their finance systems, you know, whatever it is, right? As they're making these acquisitions, they want to be able to make sure that everyone's on the same systems, et cetera. So with Forrester and my company, which had a big presence, engineering centers all through Latin America, we put together a proposal with Walmart to build an integration center out of Guadalajara, Mexico. It was about 200 people out of Mexico whose sole job and sole purpose was to help with integrations of these different acquisitions to, you know, as they would acquire a company to be able to integrate the back office systems into it. And, you know, we got awarded that project and, you know, I was on board to sort of do the program management side and the relationship management side and kind of oversee that project. And then it just sort of went from there. And, you know, and I did that for a number of years. And, you know, like I mentioned, I was doing my MBA at the time and it was very cushy. It was great. I was working for a company at the time that was about a $7 billion revenue company, had 150,000 employees, a lot of travel, but cushy, like nice salary and all those types of things. But, you know, as I like to say, like I was just a cog in a big wheel, you know? I mean, that's the problem with working for those types of big companies, right? You know, you're important, but at the end of the day, you only have so much control over what you're doing. And I was just ready to get back in the entrepreneur side. And I was ready to be able to sort of like put my thumbprint on a company and, you know, an opportunity presented myself to join a startup that was really a turnaround. But, you know, the CEO at the time was someone I had a great relationship with, knew very well, and sort of jump ship out of the cozy enterprise world into the crazy, erratic, not very well-funded startup world. And, you know, that's where I've been since. So there's been some ups and downs along the way. You know, the ups, I think, are more than the downs. But yeah, I couldn't see myself ever going back and working for a big company again.
Yeah, and I've never been in a big company as such. So I've always been interested. I did a bit of contracting, building like control systems on like oil rigs, which was really fascinating, and got a bit of those worlds, which is crazy. And I was in a startup that was inside the BBC, which is also kind of interesting to see a bit of that industry, but never actually been employed by a major company or done anything in them. So it always intrigued me, but I've never quite like taken the jump at all, and always been a bit busy doing startup-y stuff really. So I sort of feel like I should do it for a year just to like know what it's like, but not this year. Anyway, we'll see one day. But yeah, it's kind of fascinating. I definitely think I'm just going to end up sort of always being in this side of the world, really, startup things. Well, I don't know, because you say that you like have this issue with getting a bit bored of things that we both share. Have you ever felt like you should sort of stop everything for a year or two and just do music?
Oh man, that's so funny. I'll be honest with you, I am not that musically talented. Music definitely wouldn't be where I'd want to go. But one of the things that I would love to have done, or maybe, you know, one of these days that still happen, and I know you've had a chance to do this more, is take a couple years off and just travel the world. I think that would be phenomenal. I think that would be amazing. I think that's something that in general, number one, I don't think Americans do enough of. You know, I think you see that more in Europe, and Europeans are much more inclined to travel.
Yeah, it's a bit easier. There's so much difference across Europe, whereas America, it's like, it's a pretty cool place to go travel around anyway in America.
And I've had a chance to go through all Europe and Asia and see a bunch of different cultures and areas. But I think it really helps just open your eyes and realize that there's so much else out there that, you know, I think that a lot of Americans who don't have the opportunity to leave the country or choose not to leave the country really miss out. And I think it would help society in a lot of ways if people were forced to, you know, maybe after college, take a year or two off. And I think, like I said, I have a lot of friends that I've met over time that are from, you know, whether it's Europe or Australia, that's much more ingrained into the culture where it's, hey, let's take some time off and see the world, where a lot of Americans, I think it's let's graduate college and immediately start our careers. And I think if those people, you know, took that time off, you know, to really travel around the world and meet different people from different places, it would actually make our society a little bit better. I think one of the things right now that we see in this country, the US, is this kind of like rise of sort of like nationalism, and it's in the political landscape. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that Americans are raised in many ways to believe like we're the greatest nation in the world. And not that there's anything wrong with that, or that I would disagree with that in any way. It's just the fact that there's also a lot of great nations out there, and there's amazing cultures and amazing people all around the world. And I think when you get out and you have a chance to meet these people and see the way these different countries work and operate, you just realize that the world is a lot bigger than maybe you think it is. So I know that's a little bit of a tangent, but if I could take 2 years off and do anything, it would just be to travel the world.
No, I love a tangent, and I totally agree with you on both points. Traveling is brilliant. And yeah, certainly when going around America, it's been interesting compared to the amount of just in Europe, like how much more travel there is just by standards. But I still think that everywhere in the world, there's so many people that just have never really looked that far beyond their own country, or they go to just like a standard hotel where you can just be on a beach and there's no real difference to anywhere else. And certainly, I mean, I know people that like, go to Thailand, but they just go and stay in some like nice fancy hotel. And you're like, well, there's nice fancy hotels in Spain, which is like a few hours away rather than sort of 12 hours away. What was the point of going to Thailand? Like, it's really odd. Whereas, you know, other people like fully travel, much more interesting. I think Germany and Australia both have a much bigger culture of taking like a year out. I think they're probably the best for it. But UK is quite a lot of people do. It's also part of equality and like people that can afford to do it sort of helps for sure.
That's very true.
It's like it's certainly useful advice, but it's it feels a bit, yeah, hard to sort of be like, oh, well, this is what you're doing wrong kind of thing when some people don't have the option exactly.
Yeah, it's like giving an entrepreneur the advice of like, hey, don't raise capital. Just go, you know, get money from your parents. They'll help fund your company, right?
Like, definitely. So do you think that you kind of just have like 2 years off completely to travel? Or is that like as dream things? And
yeah, that's funny. So I mean, I'm like deep into like being like dad right now too, right? So I mean, my wife's amazing. She's great. I mean, obviously we're locked up in our homes right now with this corona thing, but I have a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, which are the two greatest things that ever happened to me. But like, I think, you know, I'm at a point in my life right now where I'm very dedicated and motivated with my work and continuing to build Fancy and make Fancy an amazing company. And obviously want to lead to some kind of liquidation event, you know, down the road, and, you know, the return for all of our investors and all those people involved. But I think, you know, where we're at right now, like, you know, I have kids to think about, right? So I look at it more of, you know, I got another 10 years or so of just really like heads down working, doing my things. I mean, I do my best to maintain work-life balance. I try to spend as much time with kids, make sure that we're eating dinner together every night. You know, I have my own personal things that I need to do, whether it's guitar and workout, physical fitness, and all those types of things. But I see that as something that's going to happen when, you know, the kids are out and, you know, they're away to school, and, you know, me and my wife have the opportunity to like kind of have some time to ourselves again and do some of that travel. So I think that's where that part of life kind of kicks back in. So yeah, that would be my advice to anybody out there. Do all that stuff before you have kids, or you're going to have to wait until, you know, your kids move on, because, you know, when your kids are in school and in sports and all the different things that kids do nowadays, you know, your ability to pick up and travel for a week is limited, let alone 2 years.
Definitely. As in, when you're young, it's hard to take people's advice as such or take it for real. But like, I definitely did pick up on people saying, I wish I'd done things, which wasn't so much like, Sam, you should go and do this, and more like just seeing the regrets in the face of being like, oh, I wish I'd traveled so again. Just being like, I think I need to do that thing, because I don't want to be like this old person saying, I wish I'd done something.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes, and I'll butcher it, so I'll just paraphrase it, and I think it's Mark Twain, or Mark Twain's usually attributed to it, is the one where, you know, when all said and done and you look back on life, you'll regret the things you didn't do much more than you'll regret the things you did do. And I think I heard that pretty early on in life, and I try to live that as much as possible. Like, it's so easy to make an excuse for not trying something new, or not doing something, or not going to something, and it's just, the truth of the matter is, like, you're probably going to regret not doing it. So just do it. Just try it. You know, what's the worst that could happen? You don't like it, stop doing it, whatever it is, right? So I try to do that. I mean, look, I mean, I'm a human, like, nobody does everything, and we all still have regrets in life. But, you know, I think that that's a really good way to approach life, is break out of your comfort zones, try different things. If it doesn't work out, you know, it's all right. I mean, most cases, it's not that big of a deal.
Definitely, 100%. It's a funny one that, like, you have this weird illusion of, like, what can go wrong, and, like, if the world's in it, if you don't get, like, £1 million from your startup or something, then the worst case is you end up, like, on the dole and sort of living off government money, and you can still get a job, and you probably learn lots of experience, and much better at starting a startup again next kind of thing. It's not so much to be afraid of, like, ending up living with your mum. I like my mum, it's fine. I mean, I have a mum, which is helpful for these things, but...
Yeah, and there's a good chance that, you know, there's going to be an outcome that comes out of whatever it is that you didn't even expect. You know, you're going to meet somebody, it's going to open up a relationship, an opportunity is going to present itself that you would never have, you know, even thought about. But, you know, it's that opportunity that may lead you to what, you know, ultimately you're looking for, right? And, you know, I think sometimes people get caught up and they sit in their own little rooms, offices, basements, staring at a computer screen, and they're going to try to find success through, you know, search engines and blog posts and books. And sometimes it's just getting out and meeting people.
Definitely. Yeah, I have had some pretty bad failures. Like, I went to Hong Kong with a company that was funded by an accelerator, with a guy who I was really good friends with. We'd been to, like, a few things together, done lots of travel, and he'd been building this thing. But it turns out he'd lied about lots of code and things, and then he'd sort of taken some of the money, like the initial money, to pay off some of his debts and stuff. And we just sort of had this really clusterfuck of a sort of situation where we're like, oh, so basically we've lied to all these investors, and you've now taken the money, and just like, wow, we really don't need to be a part of this. And so me and the other guy, there were three of us, so two of us just kind of like left and tried to have nothing to do with the business, but just in the middle of Asia. But end up meeting loads of really cool contacts and friends that I still have now, who are potentially helping invest in this current project. And I was on the other side of the world in Asia, having never been there, being like, well, I may as well have a year in Asia because I'm here, and like, no point just getting a ticket all the way back home. And then did all the kind of cool stuff I did in Asia, like North Korea and that stuff. And yeah, you never know what's going to happen if you sort of don't follow these things. And so the technical, like, the worst thing of, like, having a business blow up in your face was, like, actually really great. So
that's right.
Can't really complain. Strange. One thing I did want to ask, because of we're kind of going over time, was just a change in, like, the current situation, I guess, because if you've spent your last sort of main part of your career dealing with change management and, like, flipping companies up from having their problems, how do you deal with situations like this and keep things going when the company sort of is going in the wrong direction, perhaps?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's probably the thing that matured the most in over the last handful of years. I mean, had a chance to come into a number of different companies, and it's a strange dynamic, right? And it's probably something that maybe a lot of people don't deal with, right? You kind of start something from the very beginning and build it up. You go through with it, right? Where in many cases, you know, my experience has been is a founder will start something, they get initial traction, there's a business, they've raised money, they're generating revenue, but they've stalled, right? And they've hit a point to where the company isn't growing any further. And there's some form of dysfunction in some situation to where, you know, there's a decision and outside help, right? Somebody from the outside to come in and try to turn things around. And early in my career, I almost took it like a business case, like something you would learn in business school, right? So, you know, business school, kind of the way they teach you is all through these different business cases. And what they'll do is they'll map out some scenario where, hey, here's the business, here's what the revenue is, here's the business lines, here's what's profitable, here's what's not, here's what the competition's doing. What should the company do from here? And you kind of solve it and you break it apart and you look at the competitive analysis and you look at the market data and all these things, you make decisions. And that's what I was doing early on in my career. I'd come into these companies and say, hey, listen, this is working. This is not. We need to cut here. We need to grow here. And although in many cases that might have been the right sort of overall strategy, where I was completely missing the boat was the people. And this is where I think I'm getting to this when you talk about the change. It's all about your people. It's 100% how are you able to keep those people on board? And I think when you come into these organizations, you know, you need to realize that. I think with change management, you need to understand like there's a human aspect of this. This can't be determined on a spreadsheet. This can't be determined in a PowerPoint presentation. This can't be just sort of mapped out on a whiteboard. You got to think through how your people are going to react to the change. You need to be respectful of the work that they've put into that point. You need to understand what their own personal aspirations are. They have to believe that, you know, at the end of the day, you're sort of putting their best interests, even really what the company's best interests are. And I think if you can do that and the people to rally behind you and you can get the people to feel like they're part of the change, that their ideas are being heard. In many cases, they know what has worked and what hasn't worked better than you have. You get that in alignment and then they have a genuine feel that you care about them and their families and their best interests and their progressions, you know, that change is going to happen naturally. But if you come into an organization with sort of a, hey, look, I came from the outside. You guys have been messing a bunch of stuff up. Here's what we need to do now. Do these things. Even if it's the right strategy, those people aren't going to follow you and you're just not going to be very successful. So I don't know. If anybody ever gets an opportunity or gets put into a situation where they have to come into a somewhat dysfunctional organization or an organization that just needs some optimization or some change and you're kind of a new person to come in, that would be my one piece of advice. It's all about your people. It's all about your people. It's all about your people. Never that they're part of the decision. Make sure that they feel like they're heard. Be respectful of the work that they put into the past. And if they believe in you and they believe in the future direction of the company, you'll be successful. If you can't get the people to follow you, doesn't matter how great your ideas are, you won't.
That's really useful. Thanks.
Yeah, I know you're interviewing me, but I need to hear at least one story about how you almost died.
One story. Well, okay. Well, the most recent one was I shattered my leg kite surfing last year, which was a very sudden change in circumstances from like kite surfing along to being in the water with your leg just flopping around as a mess. And like, you know, like when you stub your toe and you have like 2 seconds before like you feel the true pain, but you know that you've done something and you look down and you're like,
oh,
I did that. But I looked down and my leg was just doing this. And you're like, that's not real. What's going on? And like a few seconds later, oh my God, I am dying. Oh shit.
Yeah.
Just kind of in the water for like quite a long time. Just been like, oh, I really can't move or do anything. I'm just sort of going to drift out to sea. And luckily, I had a kite surf instructor who saw it happen and kind of came and he dragged me in, basically.
Oh, man.
And like through all the waves. And oh, that was awful. Stay on the beach for a long time. It's really strange because it was like my femur, like the bigger one in your leg. Like, it's really hard to describe what it's like not having a bone there as such, because it just becomes like your leg is just, if you think of it as like just a big bag of water or something, it's like, that's really heavy. You never realize how heavy a leg is until like there's no structure in it.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
It's just like this massively heavy like thing that just sort of wants to be on the floor the whole time. You try and lift your hip at all. It's just like, oh yeah, so that was that time, the most recent. Yeah, because I mean, I couldn't really see what was going wrong in like the bone. It sort of went into like 3 main pieces, but it shot up like my core. And so I lost quite a lot of blood and I have like quite a few pints put in me, but it didn't actually like, didn't come out of me as such, just like internal bleeding. But I had no idea till I got to hospital if like it hit like an artery or anything. So I sort of had a few hours of being like, not really sure what's going to happen. And yeah, like don't do it. Have a leg again.
Was it like a type of thing where you got pulled up with a kite and then just dropped on the water and just compressed it on a board? Or
no, it was pretty like uneventful. If you're watching, you might not have noticed. I think my instructor just noticed that I was really weird after the accident, and like, so normally I try and swim to get my kite or something, and I was just sort of lay there and like, and she's like, something was wrong. But basically my foot just slipped out the board on the front foot, and like somehow I was going super fast. It was a really, really windy day, and like it just flipped really, really fast, just perfectly angled into my knee, and I just hit it at like the right angle, so like all the force just went into my thigh and it just like completely collapsed. And yeah, so I just heard like a thump and like landed in the water, and because kind of like didn't really believe it that much, as I said, when I first saw it. And yeah, even with all the pain, I still kind of like grabbed my knee and sort of like did that. I was just like, wow, what the hell is going on?
Yeah,
it's surreal. Stay in hospital in Spain for a few weeks, and that was fun. Lots of pain. It's weird because like when you think you're dying, it's not really that concerning, because I guess like death is just nothing. And so you're like, well, if I'm going to be dead, like that's a zero, and so why would I panic about dying? Because that's like worse than a zero level of feeling. And so there's no point really panicking. And if you only got a few minutes left, just be happy. Like the whole like memories flashing before your eyes and things, like no, I just sat there and was pretty content looking at the sky and and just pondered life and things.
Wow.
Yeah,
having an experience like that, has it changed your outlook on life? Like, I mean, it's, you know, people say like near death experiences like can do that.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I had pretty much the exact same experience skiing where I just took like a massive fall doing like a backflip and just never thought I was going to breathe again and hadn't back or anything. But at the time I kind of thought I had and just like, yeah, I thought I was paralyzed or something. Anyway, but like the first time it didn't change me so much, but the second time I think did, but I had done like a lot more meditation and stuff before that accident and was a lot more chilled out and a bit more mature to then like get the learnings from it. So I don't think there's ever like a good time to do these things, but it's good to have had them. So I don't really regret it as such. It's a bit annoying now that my leg's like a whole inch shorter. It's a bit unbalanced and I ended up straining my other leg just trying to run and things. So that's a pain because I'd like to do like marathons and these kind of things, but it does, yeah, change your outlook in things. And one, like concern for yourself to like not do stuff that's so stupid. But two, just realize that your body is just like this thing that isn't really yours. It's like you have your mind, you don't really control what happens to your body. And thinking about things, and I was pretty happy just after the surgery when my leg had been put back together and like actually had some solid form to it. I was like, oh my God, this is insanely amazing. Even though super painful, I could barely move it at all and stuff. But if you think about that, the same perspective, if like half an hour beforehand, like I'd been completely fine, but then like my friend had come in and just had like beaten the shit into me and like I'd end up with a leg in the same place, I'd have been like so sad and depressed that my friend had beaten me up and that I now had like this leg that someone had done to me. But because I'd met the problem myself and I had spent some time like wondering if I'd even have a leg still, I was super happy, even though my actual position in life was the same. And just sort of thinking about how you perceive things and get annoyed by stuff from other people and other things, even though you don't need to, it's just like, it's entirely how you feel about it. And like you make your own decisions about your perspectives of things. So like when you get annoyed, it's like you are annoying yourself. It's not someone else that's annoying you kind of thing. That really helped drive that concept home a lot more than just reading that in a book, because
yeah
I guess that was helpful for sure.
It's great, makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know, I could probably talk about different things for hours, but yeah, I might go on a bit too long.
You know, I mean, you're an interesting guy, and I think as we're talking here, it's nice to have it, you know, feel like more like a conversation between the two of us. So your background, you've done some really interesting cool stuff. I mean, just even doing what you're doing right now, right? Like you have a podcast out there, you have all these different conversations, like it's really cool. Like what fascinates me is always people, and I just admire people who are willing to just try different things and take on risks. I'm sure the first time you ever did a podcast, you probably had a lot of questions of yourself, like what am I doing, is this something I should be doing? And when you get started, and you know, I mean, probably hundreds of these things later, you know, it's, you've been able to do it yourself. So I applaud you for that.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I did find it quite hard initially. I was really a very confident speaker when I was younger at all. And I had like verbal dyslexia and it took a long time to even find words and stuff. I didn't really speak to people even that much. So it was quite a hard one to get used to talking more. And it was all just interviews like the first year, but I still even just recording like the intro myself and things was, it took me literally 8 months in the first year before I even started releasing things because I couldn't record stuff by myself. Whereas now I started doing stand-up comedy this year and that's like,
oh really?
A few years ago, that would have been just like so impossible to even comprehend. And now I'm like, oh yeah, I've headlined a stand-up comedy show. And you're like, what the hell? It's just very surreal.
Wow. I find that so fascinating. And having listened to a lot of the casts out there that I listen to for more enjoyment, you know, there are comedians and people like that that are running the podcast, you know, there's like Mark Maron or whoever, you know, when they have other comedians come on and they just talk about sort of shop and, you know, that effort of it, what it becomes to be a comedian and just that understanding that like these comedians, these guys that are super, super successful, it's like, how do you become a successful comedian? And the answer is always like, go up on stage and bomb like 1,000 times, right? Like go up there and just suck forever and eventually you're going to get good. But, you know, that ability to just get up in front of a group of people and try to make them laugh. And I mean, it's like, that's one of those things where I think part of me would like to try it, but as brave as I sound, I don't know. That's one of those things that is pretty frightening.
Yes. It's one of those things that I guess like comfort zones of pushing yourself. So if you maybe did like just a normal public speaking course first or something, or started a podcast for a few years and did your own things, and then maybe it would become a bit more like feasible. So, I mean, I've kind of wanted to do it for, I guess, like a year, but asked to do a TEDx speech. And that was kind of like the forcing function to like, actually, I just need some stage time. And like, I want to do a TEDx speech that's kind of funny. Like I wanted like people to laugh and things. And so it forced me to do a stand-up comedy course, which then, yeah, made me do the stage time and like do all these things. And it's a really weird one because I wouldn't say I'm like naturally the most funny people. Like I've got like a WhatsApp group with a bunch of friends where I genuinely feel like everything they say is really hilarious. And I feel quite inept on this group because I'm just not making a joke out of everything. But it's just sort of going that level deeper on like whatever situation you're in, just sort of spending like a few hours thinking about how you could come up with like a funny thing, or just thinking about all the different words to do with it that could be a pun or something. There's just so many ways to just find some humor in something if you spend time with it. And then just practice it on people and practice it and practice it. And like, you'll be sort of working for like 2 hours and like nothing might come, but then you'll bike somewhere else for half an hour. If you don't put a podcast on, you just sort of sit there with your own thoughts, like just things drop in and you're like, oh crap, this would be hilarious. And it's not necessarily just being naturally funny. It's sort of calculated, but you can still do it even if you're not someone that just instantly comes up with jokes, I guess.
It seems like there's those people out there that are just naturally just gifted. And we all know those people, right? It's like, you can just get up on stage, even what they're saying might not even be that funny if you break it out. It's almost like the way they say it, it's just hilarious. And then there's like the comedians out there that you can tell, it's like, they're not the kind of person that would just walk in a room and everybody would think be the funniest person in the room, but they just understand how to like dissect a joke and understand how to kind of see the humor and different things, be able to present their ideas. And it's almost like that refinement too, right? I'm assuming sometimes it's like, I have a funny concept, but now I got to try 20 different ways to get that concept out in a way that resonates with the audience, right? And there's almost probably that scientific approach of being able to tell the joke the right way, right?
Yeah. There's lots of learning about how to tell a joke as well, because you think about something that's funny as a concept, but you need to build it up like very quick. So and if you have like a story that's kind of a funny story, if you tell it over 2 minutes, it's just like long and boring. You need to, the minimum information to understand it should be done in like one line to kind of get able to buy in, and then like to the setup line and then like deliver it. But like the word that makes you sort of switch to it being funny should be right at the end, because then if you say the word that's funny but then you carry on with your sentence to explain it, people kind of get what the G is, but like they still need some more things, and so it kind of falls a bit flat. So it's like, it's a lot of timing and the exact nuances of how you say something, cause so that it's delivered at the moment where like everyone can just sort of like get all the tension and their thoughts resolved in this one funny thing and then laugh because there's nothing else to say. And it's like, it's really calculated and not that easy to just sort of say things naturally funny if you're not a natural at it, I guess. But you should learn about like, yeah, how to deliver these things a lot more, which is really interesting. And I'm pretty sure if you just did a course, like a 7-week course, something that I did, it's suddenly doing it, it felt very natural and normal, and like you'd be able to get on the stage at the end of it. Whereas before, like you'd be just like, well, how, this is just so impossible to just stand up and be like hilarious for 5 minutes. But spend like just 2 hours every week for 7 weeks just working on some things and having the concepts brought to you like that, like it's actually kind of doable, which is great for like growth mindset and just be like, oh, just put a bit of time into anything, it sort of happens. And same with like playing guitar or something. So many people could have think, oh, maybe I could be good at guitar, and they could pick it up and go, oh wow, it's really hard to make a chord, so try it for 5 minutes, like wow, this is completely impossible, you can't perceive how you could do all the weird things with your fingers and sort of stop. But you're like, well, you just sort of struggle and just do it for like 5-10 minutes a day for a few weeks, and then you can probably do it for like 20 minutes a day, and then yeah, after like a month you can probably practice for a whole hour and actually be making stuff that sounds like music. But
well, it's almost true for everything, right? I think it's like when you try to do anything, if you all of a sudden jump to the end and think to yourself like, god, that just seems so, you know, monumental, how am I ever going to get there, you can get so overwhelmed where you just don't even start. And sometimes all it takes is just start, right? Like just all I'm going to do a start. I don't know where this is going to go. I'm just going to start. And then, you know, it's like you said, you just pick up the guitar, you strum some strings. All right, I'm going to teach myself one chord. Okay, good. Now I got the G down. Like, maybe I'll teach myself how to go from G to D, right? And then it's like, before you know it, you're playing guitar. But like, if you sit down and you just try to like imagine yourself knowing how to do all these different things and solo and guitar and play, like it's just so overwhelming, you'll never start, right? I think that's really good advice. It's like, you know, I always tell my team the old question of like, how do you eat an elephant? And the answer is one bite at a time. You know, that's all you got to do is you got to just take that first small little bite and kind of make that progress towards your goal.
Yeah, same like the biggest journey, start with a single step kind of thing.
That's right. Yeah, same thing.
Yeah, it's a good one for right now, because I did a short podcast on this. It was like my life hack for last year, where I basically said that if you go to work or anything, and people, you know, take smoking breaks. I was kind of always annoyed that these people got to go for like a break. And so I started doing skill breaks. So whenever people were doing that, I just go and join them. But I just do like juggling or like something that I wouldn't do, but just for like 5 minutes. And you can do the same with a guitar or something, and just be bad at something for 5 minutes. Because if you try and juggle, like you drop balls. And so people do it for about 30 seconds and they can decide they don't do it. You just need to do it for like 5 minutes a day for like 2 weeks, and you'll start catching them, and you just break the back of being able to start. And then like once you actually start catching it, you kind of juggle three, you can then start thinking about like doing something complicated or trying to add a new ball, and like you can practice it for a long amount of time. But you just have to just be shit at something like repeatedly. The same, it doesn't matter whether it's guitar or anything, but it's just like, it's a really small amount of time, but you can kind of just put it into your day anywhere if you just have something you wanted to be good at, or like handstanding or any of these things. Last question, super fast. What is the kindest thing someone has done for you?
Oh man, my wife is like my biggest fan, my biggest supporter. She believes in me even sometimes when I start to question myself. And from a kindness perspective, that just helps me continue to move on and gives me sort of the energy and the confidence and the different things I need to be able to kind of take on the day-to-day challenges that we all face as you know, business professionals.
Cool. Yeah, I don't have a wife. Could totally do with one, I think. It sounds like one day.
Yeah, they're helpful, man. It's good to have a fan base, a built-in fan base.
Do you remember how you met your wife and what you said to get her to like date you?
I do. So this is probably a little bit of a regional story. I don't know if you're an NBA basketball fan. So my wife's from Sacramento. It's kind of northern part of California here. And their basketball team is the Sacramento Kings. And she grew up as a Kings fan. Her dad had season tickets. And at that time, the Kings were, this is 2002, 2001, whatever it was, were really, really good. And the Lakers were like their big nemesis, right? Kobe Bryant, Shaquille O'Neal. And I was not a Lakers fan. And she was in Southern California where everybody was Lakers fans. So we were talking about basketball. And I think the fact that I told her I was a Kings fan and I liked her team that she grew up watching was enough for her to like enter into the conversation. And then we were friends for probably 6 months before we ever really started dating. But I think that's how it all started.
Wow. Do you remember how you like up the ante to sort of started dating?
She's going to kill me for telling this story. When we first met, she had a boyfriend at the time. She was dating somebody long distance. Oh, shit. So I always tell her I had like a crush on her from day one, but I'm a respectful guy and I knew she had a boyfriend. And so we never crossed a line. We were just friends, like I said, but you know, as our friendship grew, I think it was growing on both sides. So she let me know that she broke up with her boyfriend. She basically said she wanted to go out with me.
Nice. Yeah, it's funny, like at the time these things don't seem like they could be so significant, but like, yeah, I know that you would be the people sort of to spend the rest of your life together, but then you're kind of tied to like a different relationship, it sort of seems like you shouldn't go and do it, but yeah cool. And that worked out for you.
Yeah, it worked out, man. We just had our 14th year anniversary. We've been together for 18 years, got two kids. So
nice.
Trucking along. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Well, thanks so much. It's been great catching up with you and been interesting to have a nice couple of things than just a grilling interview and such.
Yeah.
So cool.
I enjoyed it too. Appreciate it.
Nice.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @GrowthMindsetPodcast or follow me @SamJamSnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.